Second.
Okay, this is tape two with John Wilson.
Jerry Lenfest came back for his, I think it was his 35th reunion, class of 53. He must have been 88. And Frank Parsons was asked to have dinner with the class. You know, when, at reunion time, all the classes are having banquets at the same time, so we spread ourselves out, and Frank had the assignment. And he mentioned it in passing, I think, at the class of 53, that we had a project under planning, but that we didn't have it fully funded yet, and that we wouldn't be able to go forward until the funding were visible, you know. And so afterward, he said to Frank, Frank, what are you short? And Frank said, well, it looks like as much as $3 million. And he said, well, why don't you ask the president to come up to Philadelphia as soon as he can, and we can talk about it. So Ferris and I got in our little car not very long after that and met with Jerry and Marguerite Lenfest at a restaurant in downtown Philadelphia. And Jerry said, look, I think we ought to get the business part of this over with before we have lunch, because this is a wonderful restaurant. I want you to enjoy this lunch. He said, I understand you have a $3 million shortfall on the funds that you've had committed to this project. It was a $10 million project. I said, yes, sir, and we just can't go forward with that kind of gap. He said, well, Marguerite, what do you think? She said, Jerry, it's your money. You do with it what you can you imagine, Marguerite? Wonderful gal. You do with it whatever you want. I said, okay, well, I'll do $3 million. Now, let's have lunch. And I said, you sure know how to make a guy relax over lunch. Instead of having to sit there and worry the whole lunch through, you know. So that really, that was a successful building design, by the way, way, way back. Bob Huntley had appointed a San Antonio firm to design this thing because a San Antonio alumnus had said, if you hire Ford Carson, whatever, two or three names there, I'll pay the architect's fee to work up some idea. This was a 300-seat theater thing. Well, they had a building designed fit onto that lot with the fly loft on the corner. In other words, you'd have nothing but sheer brick, you know, as you walk along the creek and look up.
Look up, that's
what that would have been on the corner one, too. It would have been then incorporated the old building as a lobby, the railroad station building. It would all fit on this side of the railroad track embankment. I mean, this side meaning the toward the town side. A small building, but this huge, great fly loft. Meanwhile, Gaines Hall was being designed. So we asked Eddie Smith of Marcellus Wright Cox and Smith to take a look at this building that we all thought was wrong. And Eddie started to look at the whole. I said, I want this to be a main intersection of the university, a new entryway, as it were, and we'll take the curse off the Warner Center brick by, you know, landscaping and get as much greenery going up it as we possibly can over time. But Gaines Hall sits on where a gas station used to be, you may remember, and a Coca-Cola bottling plant. Across the street were abandoned oil and gas tanks. I mean, I don't want oil tanks. I guess they were great big Exxon tanks or something sitting on the front. And so Eddie started, I said, let's try to harmonize this whole entryway. I said, I also want an announcement that this is the university. So I'd like to see some signage, you know, Washington University, 1749, etc. And that didn't come out quite the way I wanted it, but we had the two lines, the Lenfest Center line and the Warner Center side line, you know, where the landscape, where the trees were planted in two profuse amount on that side hill, you know. I wanted to see green there and spotlights on the... Anyway, we got most of it done. But then Gaines had this... what do you want to call it? I better be careful because... what did... I can't think of anybody anymore. Fred...
Fred Cox?
No, Fred Haskell. Fred, you know, Fred's wife,
Winifred.
Hadsel. Mm-hmm. Winifred Hadsel. I don't think much of the building, but she called it Neo something or other. But anyway, we wanted very much to get a touch of the colonnade. That's why we had the cupola and the columns and the... And I said, I want this to be a gatehouse. I don't want it to be a rotunda. We're not taking on Charlottesville. This is going to be an Anglo-Saxon thing, a gatehouse rather than a rotunda, a Roman thing. So when Lenfest came along, I said, Eddie, reach across the street and pick up some elements here and work with Ford Carson. I forgot the architect's name now. It's funny how just a few years have passed. But anyway, so we got another... focal point, entryway, and that's going to be repeated, by the way, on the tennis pavilion that's underway at the moment. But, and then we did some very nice things there architecturally. I mean, these people came up with the ideas of using the old railroad right-of-way as a crosswalk across from, and then to have that, just, you know, non-functional entryway, but it does distribute crowds from up and down, and faculty on the second floor, and all that stuff. So that was all. I give Frank a lot of credit for whatever he said about the arts, but Jerry's just spontaneous generosity. He added $2 million to that before it was over to help endow it and all that stuff.
One of the things I was very impressed with at the Christmas concert was that the place was packed.
Oh, it's always packed.
It was full. And I just thought that was wonderful. And it wasn't, they weren't familiar faces. And I know a lot of people in town. There just seemed to be all kinds of people there.
Well, that Christmas concert is a very popular one, and but it never really filled in Lee Chapel, never. And we had a lot of nice things go on in Lee Chapel that no one came to. It's hard to get to and park. And seating was very uncomfortable. And if you had a chorus of any size, you couldn't put them on the stage, and you had platforms that extended over the first two rows, you remember, the seats there. But it was acoustically pretty good. And I was a little fearful in my heart of hearts that we'd build a wonderful new performing arts center, but some music faculty member will say, I prefer Lee Chapel for the acoustics. I don't give a damn whether anybody's comfortable or anybody comes. You know, I get to see that purist view. But we got some good acoustics by luck in Lenfest. If we hadn't, I suspect we would have had a real problem. Then of course, the theater's done some wonderful things there, too, in the large building, too. I thought that Skin of Our Teeth, the Wilder thing a few years ago, was really first rate. And then Evita was beyond belief, if you didn't see Evita.
No, I wasn't here.
Well, they gave me a little evening
of
music.
That's quite something to take on.
Oh, gosh. Well, we had people from Hollywood here, alums, writers and... producers, and then they said this is clearly at professional level. I mean, we had an Evita. Well, before we left, last May, they did a salute to us in the Lenfest Center, and they brought back people who had performed in these outstanding things in Lenfest since it was created. And they had a scene from Evita, in effect, musically reproduced. It was just wonderful. But there have been some great, great things that have combined both music and theater, and by theater by itself alone, that memorable. And it's brought town and university together. see the tennis pavilion will do the same thing. People don't realize that. But here at VPI, they've got 6 indoor courts. I'm a key member of this community in terms of the belonging to the VPI Tennis Club or whatever they call it. And you pay X amount of dollars per term to belong to the club, and then you pay court time. We're grateful to have the chance to do that. That's going to happen at Washington Lee, I'm sure. It'll be something that the townsfolk will, you know, the varsity will use it in the late afternoon and on weekends when they have matches and so on, or when visitors are coming down and you can't play outside. There'll be a lot of student use, and there'll be a lot of town use of that facility. So that'll be another close.
What about the relationship between the university and the town?
Well, I suppose we should say the city.
The city. The city. I keep hearing the expression town gown, so.
Yeah, well,
but, you're right. It certainly is a city.
I think that Buddy has been really good. Of course, before we
Buddy
had...
Buddy Derrick, the mayor?
Yeah, he's a lovely person. Before, Charles Phillips was mayor for 12 or 14 years, you know, and was a key member of our faculty. And he was, of course, a facilitator when it came to town-gown relationships. I think David Howison has been good, and he created with the town manager a forum for monthly meetings between officers of the city and officers and students of the university. Our relationship with Chief Baird have been good, and David has done a lot with Mike and others to increase the mutual confidence in how the things will interact. You have 2,000 young people, 1,625 of whom are undergraduates, and there's an awful lot of energy, and there's an awful lot of parking congestion and things of that sort that people resent, and everybody takes turns saying that vacation time, oh, this is the new Lexington, what a wonderful thing, and there aren't any students around. The merchants know better. In fact, I once, talking to Martha Lou Derrick, said, Martha Lou, what percentage of your business would you attribute to Washington and Lee? A third? Oh, she said it would be more than that. I had no idea what it was, but it was more than a third. So most people realize that first of all, the students, though they will put a strain on day-to-day life in the city, are a key financial or economic part of the community's success. The two institutions create a wonderful resource for the community to enjoy, and I think most people appreciate that. Why did I move to Blacksburg? I needed to leave Lexington because I needed to give room to John to flourish, one. And two, I came to Blacksburg because it's a university town. We want to live in a small town, which would be unbearable if it weren't a university town. There would be no music. There would be no theater. There would be no lectures coming from abroad, as it were. There would be no athletic events to attend. I mean, the quality of life that an institution of higher learning gives, not only to itself, kind of a gift to itself, but also to the surrounding populations, is really very, very remarkable. And I think some people sort of take it for granted in Lexington, but that's inevitable. I felt sometimes that we were underappreciated and that BMI got far too much credit. They commandeered a platoon to go over to Buena Vista to help mop out after one of the floods, you know. Newspapers were full of it. And yet our kids were doing some good things, too. We never seemed to get credit for anything but the Saturday night rumble, you know. So, but that's kind of because I was sensitive about it.
Well, I don't want to bring up a sore subject, but speaking of Saturday Night Rumbles, there's one story that Frank asked me to get your point of view on, And I wish we'd done this back when we were talking about these things, because we've been talking about such pleasant things now. He said that there was a bottle-throwing incident, and that's all I needed to say to you, that you would know exactly what I was referring to.
Well, this is a very great disappointment to me, because it came right in the wake of our renovation of two of our houses, SAE and Phi Psi next to it. On that little stretch, you have also Pi Phi down at the corner. I can never keep them straight. Pi Phi, SAE, and Phi Psi. And
Kappa. Oh, I'm glad I'm not the only one who can't keep them all straight.
And Kappa Sig had a little White House in there that should become the Outing Club Center now. And there used to be a fair amount of antagonism that would arise.
Now, where is this?
On Washington Street.
On Washington, okay.
You're going right up Washington Street toward the shopping area out there, past the police station on your left. There are these big houses. SAE is the white one. And next to it is a lovely brick house with a curved entryway. Staircase that curves up to a door, entry door.
This is near City Hall?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we just finished SAE, and that was a very expensive renovation, one of the most expensive. 900 and some thousand. Actually, it touched a million. But the alums kicked in for a grand piano or something. And I think we could say, honestly, it was $9.99 or something. Anyway, and Phi Psi was not done yet. And a house mother had moved into an apartment in SAE on the Phi Psi side of the house. And an SAE kid, he turned out to be a really nice boy, unfortunately, but came home probably with a few beers, too many in his system. But he just had a instinct to reach down and throw a bottle through the window of the Phi Psi house. It shattered glass across the room. There was a party going on, but it was all over the house. There wasn't any specific, nobody was hurt. There were two or three were made angry. And so these two guys came out and started to rain bottles on the SAE house. And one of them went right through the window of the house mother's apartment, living room, which must have terrorized her. I don't mean frightened her. I mean, what would you think? You're a 65 or 70-year-old house mother, newly appointed SAE, newly renovated house. And somebody throws a bottle. It's a felony. You throw a projectile through a window at, after dark, especially, an occupied thing. Anyway, the next few days were taken up with the worst bit of stonewalling I've ever encountered. No one in either house would say, we'll take care of it, we're paying for the damages. That was a traditional way for fraternities to fix these things. We're going to pay for the window. I was beside myself with the prospect of these guys thinking there was nothing exceptional about this kind of behavior and that it was something you could fix up just because they both had enough money to fix it up. They wouldn't tell us who was involved. They just said, leave that to, this is something we can leave the fraternity system. I said, I'm not leaving it to the fraternity system. Called in Murph. I said, Murph, I want you to find out who these three people were. About 10 minutes later, he came back with their names. So I said, I want them to be brought in here serially. I don't want them to come at once. I don't want them to have an opportunity to talk to each other. So you get one. Took one off the baseball field he was practicing and brought him to me, and I simply said, did you or did you not throw a bottle to the so-and-so? Well, yes, sir, I did. I said, good, go over there, and there's my telephone on the desk. Dial 1. your father's area code number and his office number and tell him on the telephone that you've just been suspended from the university for the rest of the year by the president and that he is here if you want to talk with him. Kid went over, dialed one, dialed the area code. He put it back down. He said, couldn't we talk about this a little bit more? Which is, I'm making a point here, and that is that we often overlook the powerful influence that parents can have. They're very rarely brought into these things, and I know it's gauche to do that. But I thought it wouldn't be bad to have the parents aware of what was happening. next kid who came in called his home, and unfortunately his mother wasn't there, and he told his sister that he was in deep trouble in the university, and she just alarmed the mother, something awful, and that backfired. But at any rate, we suspended them for the remainder of that semester, so they lost a semester's work. Students were outraged, fraternity students, which consisted of hundreds. I mean, 550 showed up in Lee Chapel, hanging over the edges of the balcony to talk with me about this. And the high-minded theme, of course, was that I had circumvented the judicial system that was in place, and that if I had wanted to do so, why didn't I call this to the attention of the judicial board of the Interfraternity Council? And it was a little hard to stand up and say, well, that has never worked. It is a buffer. It is a protective device to keep the import in significance of these acts from ever having to be encountered. And anyway, it was a very uncomfortable evening in the Lee Chapel as I tried to explain to these young people that we were not going to tolerate things like that, and that I had a responsibility that superseded any of the other, and that there was a clause somewhere in the Constitution of the university that said in the event of a significant threat to the welfare of the institution, the president could suspend or expel, and that I thought it was that serious. Oh, well, that didn't go down well, you know, and I knew they had to have a kind of cathartic evening, and so I just sort of steeled myself to absorb such animosity as there was in the building. One of them was especially vituperative type up here on the left, and he asked all kinds of aggressive questions, you know. And I found out it was Mason Pope, who was one of the best running backs that we'd ever had around there. So I didn't know who, I couldn't see who he was, or I wouldn't have recognized him anyway. But anyway, I called Mason in the next day. I said, come on by, I want to talk to you. And we had a wonderful hour and a half. You know, he was very candid, and he hadn't relaxed his view, but we had an opportunity to exchange views on it in a somewhat less pressured. And I had told him that I had admired his play on the field, and I was very pleased to get to know him a little bit better. You know, I didn't have any of this stuff hanging on the walls of my office, you can be sure. My wife did all this stuff. But anyway, he found out that I wasn't quite the ogre that he'd worked it out that I probably was. And interestingly enough, years later, I'm writing letters of recommendation for Mason, you know, to various. He's doing very well in New York in the financial business. A brokerage house. But anyway, that was one of those things. In the front row of that Lee Chapel event were the officers of the two houses involved, plus the IFC and the Greek. And you know, I just didn't feel they had got it, you know, that they hadn't really picked up on what was happening. And they were going to whitewash this thing. And the arrogance of saying, it's none of my business, in effect, who did it, we'll handle that, you know, was almost too much to bear. The faculty, without my ever even raising the matter in the faculty meeting, somebody came in with a resolution of total support, you know, and everybody passed it unanimously.
Did you see this as a threat to the whole Renaissance program?
I did. I thought it would just be the start of an unraveling of the whole investment, the whole commitment. Right back to business as usual, except you had a lady in there you'd appointed to help set a tone and a style, and had her assaulted in that indirect way. She could have been sitting there. It wouldn't have made the slightest difference.
Well, was that the end of serious problems? Did anything else occur?
Nothing like that. We haven't had... You know what? This breaking windows thing just made me sick. I'm from a very modest family background. My father's a blue-collar, was a blue-collar sort of guy. He worked in a machine tool and die thing near the auto industry in Michigan. We didn't have much. But my gosh, the idea of these people wasting the world's goods. I would come on a Monday and I would see our B&G guys, who don't have much in the world, and gals, cleaning up after. They would be broken windows in the dormitory. They would come back from the fraternities, having destroyed the house all night, and then knock out a few windows in the dormitory. The windows they knocked out were always in the public sector, the staircases, not their own rooms. So then they would plead, if we ever found out who did it, they would plead alcohol. They had been too drunk to govern their own behavior. But they weren't, you weren't drunk enough not to make the distinction between a public and a private space in the dormitory. Don't give me that. This would sicken me on Sunday morning when I would walk around there and I'd look up and see Graham Lee's... windows out from people coming back from an orgy, that's too strong a term, but an unregulated party, you know. During this whole period, we went from 18 years old to 21 years old. That was not...
Tell me about that. When did that happen? I've been trying to track that down.
I wouldn't trust my memory.
Nobody does.
But the pavilion, it would be around the time the pavilion was built, because we built the pavilion. When we thought, well, we'll help ease the strain on the fraternities by having an on-campus place where we can have parties, and there will be some, we can govern the awful possibility of high school kids coming into these, they were going into fraternity houses and drinking, you know, the grain alcohol was the drink of preference, and high school girls, 16-year-old, it didn't matter. We would have more control over it. Well, we no sooner built the pavilion than the laws of the state of Virginia changed to 21. And for a while there, we thought, gosh, we got a white elephant, albeit not a major facility, but we could use it athletically, and we can use it for other purposes. But it was a place that they didn't want to go to socialize, because three-fourths of them couldn't have anything to drink there. And in the ABC had rules about that. If the audience could be predicted to be less than half eligible to drink, then you couldn't have alcohol at all, and you know, things of that sort. So it was around the time the pavilion was built, which I guess I'd say 85, 86, somewhere.
One thing that I have been interested in studying the student handbooks, there comes a time, right about that time, where a very definitive policy on alcohol suddenly appears. Prior to that, there had been a policy on drugs, and it was as if alcohol was not part of the scene. I mean, it just wasn't addressed. And then suddenly there was this very long involved policy on alcohol. Where does a policy like that come from?
There were a number of, Lou, I don't remember when Lou John probably served in the deanship until about 89. I think David came 89 or 90, somewhere there. Lou made the case to me, as did many professional people across the country, that alcohol was a more serious problem than drugs. And I said, you guys are all saying that only because you're scared of drugs, just as I am. It's far more comforting to say something familiar like alcohol is the major problem. Forget cocaine. I mean, which we, none of us knew anything about from our own experience and so on. But Lou had a very strong perception that alcohol was our number one problem. And we had an agency, something like the University Health Committee, which now David has, which promulgates proposed policy on a whole number of fronts, but certainly alcohol is, alcohol abuse is one such. There's just simply been an awful lot of national attention paid to this in the last few years, and Harvard did a big study, and the University of Michigan has counter studies going on, and everybody's taking the pulse of what turns out to be a study of binge drinking, you know, binging or whatever the participle form would be. And on the board side, there never was a standing committee on campus life. That was another change we made. We created a standing committee on campus life, and they heard every meeting from the dean of students and from student leaders on a whole range of things, fraternities and athletics and social life and so on. That's been helpful. Tom Touchton, again, was very strongly favorable toward strengthening our stated policy with respect to alcohol. He chaired that committee for a while.
Did establishing that policy make a difference?
Well, I think, you know, who reads the official documents of the university? Maybe before you come here,
you know, I may be the only one who's reading all of them.
Student handbook maybe read by freshmen, but they don't consult it every year after they get here. But insofar as it helps you in the steps that you take in the daily administration of the affairs of the institution, well, we've got a policy. We're held, the administration, after all, must implement the policies of the board. So that's helpful. And I am very sure that David has pointed it out a number of times to student leaders that this, I think it was the last year I was there, we had a meeting in 114 in the student center, or whatever you call it, Evans, not Evans, but whatever the rest of that's called. Anyway, he had a dean of student staff there, he had the infirmary director there, and she was very effective, by the way, and students who were involved, and there was a discussion about the threat to this generation of, that not just ours, that alcohol represented, and he asked me to say a few words that night, which I did, and so you have a policy that sort of is there as a backstop or as a reflection of what it is you try to do in day-to-day life. But you have in David, too. I mean, I don't want to say anything negative about Lou's time, but he was dean for nearly 20 years. And, this is off the record, but Danny Murphy was the associate in his office at that time. In for Greek affairs, fraternities and such. Danny hadn't been in any of these houses ever. And I said, Danny, I don't understand. I want to have meetings with the officers of all the houses, and I want you to come with me when I go down and talk about the management of these houses, or what their budget looks like, how they go about pledging. And I want to know everything that I can know about. And he said, I've never been in these, I found out, I've never been in these houses. And I said, what prompted you to decide not to do that? He said, well, because I'm on the student judicial committee or whatever it is, some group that finally adjudicates individual infractions. I felt it would be wrong to get to know them too well, because I may have to judge them. I said, what do fathers do? I mean, that's the role of fathers, or indeed mothers. you know them and you love them, but you also discipline them. And I don't see a contradiction in that role. But there were things like that, you see, just falling into. It's easier not to go down there and face this stuff. But anyway, yeah, the policy helps. It reflects the board's concern. The board is the ultimate authority for all the things that matter at the institution. It doesn't exercise that authority, except through the administration and the faculty, 99% of the time. Faculty have significant delegated powers when it comes to student life and at Washington and Lee.
Is that unusual?
Well, it may be true at other places, but it's never exercised. I mean, the more the faculty can forget about student life, the happier they are in most places.
But that's not true at Washington and Lee.
No, I don't think it is. You've got faculty involved in the what used to be the Confidential Review Committee, which is now called something else. It handles confidential matters like sexual assault or sexual misbehavior. What is it called? We changed its name the last year or so. I've just flushed my mind of all these things.
It's happening, but all the things that occasionally people call me from the archives and ask me a question, I say, I'm sorry, it's all been replaced with Washington and Lee, so I don't remember any of that anymore.
Anyway, and the faculty recognize that the life of the intellectual life of the place can't go on oblivious to all the other compartments of life that have an impact on it. So I think they are far more seriously involved in these matters than is true most places.
Well, you have had a really remarkable time at that university. And I'm very touched to hear you still very much use the first person plural. You may physically be removed from it, but emotionally you're obviously still very much there.
Well, that's true. It was the happiest, in spite of some of the difficulties, really was the happiest 12 and a half years of my career. And Anne became very fond of the students at Washington Lee. She knew more of them than I did. She really did. We weren't great entertainers. We had our special occasions and our special events and our friends, but she knew especially what I felt. Well, it also played to my own interest, but I was going to say that I watched them perform on the athletic field and courts, and I watched them in music and in theater, and I watched student government leadership develop and played a hand occasionally in that. But I didn't try to. I've never been to a student party except for an hour in a fancy dress every year. And I could have done more, I'm quite sure, to come to know the students better. I just got a copy of a class of 1994 annual fund committee letter, newsletter of some sort. It was wonderful. But I looked down the list of people, you know, I thought, not the list, but they, you know, Sylvia has just had a baby and so on. So many I didn't know. You know, 94 was a pretty good class. Some I did, of course, know pretty well. So I've always regretted not coming to know the students better, but you can't do everything. You know, finally you have to say, well, I'm going to give my time and attention to this. And I did enjoy watching them play and watching them perform. And we really loved the place, we really did. I think it is a remarkable place. I was talking with some VPI people the other day at a luncheon, some Hollins people the other night. I met with the chairman of the board and with a couple of trustees at Hollins. And this was the day Maggie announced her decision to go to St. Mary's, but they said, well, what do you think about the, do you still love Hollins? You know. I was on the board, and I served Hollins faithfully for a while as a trustee and chaired the search committee for the presidency and some other things. Not for Maggie, but for earlier President Paula Brownlee. And I resigned from the board when I accepted the Washoe Lee position because I knew there would be conflicts of interest, fundraising and others. But anyway, I said, well, you know, there's no faculty I've ever worked with at Wells or at Hollins, a little distant from, didn't work directly with them, but as a trustee, even at BPI, I've never met a faculty as civil as this faculty. They don't need to score points off each other. They're not trying to show off in faculty meetings by showing how clever and witty they are. They never at the expense of somebody else. If they disagree with a position, they will say it with the utmost respect, or they'll keep quiet if they don't know how to do it, and maybe take it up in another way, in another form. I said, very unusual. And I said, the Hollins faculty, frankly, though I never sat with them in a faculty meeting as president or anything like that, but I did have intercourse with them as a member of the board and a committee on conference that used to talk with faculty directly and so on. And I said, I think they're spoiled. I think they think they're quite good, I'm sure, in their fields and everything, but I think they've decided that maybe they're better than the place they're now serving. You know, that's nothing worse than that. To have a faculty said, well, for the grace of God, I'd be at Harvard today. You know. So that made life at Washington Lee very special, to have a faculty so supportive. And another thing that I found out was the Hollins faculty are up in arms about the reorientation of a building on the front of the campus and the gateway. And so I said, you know, that never came up at Washington Lee. I had my sector of responsibility, not officially demarcated, but clearly understood that I could build a little building out at the B&G complex up on the hill there for $50,000, a metal building. Nobody'd say, why are you spending the university's money to build a B&G building? Or why did you build that pavilion? Or why are you building a $2 million tennis court? The faculty kind of, there was a trust there. Say, we look after our part. You don't come in and tell us how to teach biology 101, and we'll let you spend too much money in renovating the locker room over at the stadium, or, you know, or whatever. And nobody's ever said, let's have a committee on the budget. Oh, my God, that would be terrible. I mean, to try to educate a constantly changing committee of faculty on the intricacies of the budget. One, two, take the fun away from the job. The only fun you have, honestly, is being able to see something accomplished, which usually means trying to allocate some resources in a real development of the arts. Beyond the Lenfest Center comes in the budget. How much more money we now spend to bring visiting groups in than we used to spend, for example. And, of course, to sustain more faculty. And, you know, there are adjunct teachers of instruments over there. That if you listed all the well, you could get the program out. When that little celebration for Ann and for me last May, they say, here's what we were, here's what we are now, you know. That, frankly, is the fun of it, to see something grow and develop. If I had to work that through a committee, I mean, committees are good places to obfuscate where responsibility lies. I mean, you can also, I recognize the importance of them. And,
there are a lot of committees at Washington and Lee.
Yeah, but, you know, they're not impediments to making some forward movements from time to time, thank God. I had that kind of liberty, or I took it. I think I had it. I never was questioned about that. Even, you know, Mr. Duchess, while I called, I had his person call, and say, John, I want to give $1 million to the campaign, but I want it to be in honor of you and Ann, and you are to select whatever you want to do with it. I felt like a millionaire for a week. I called Barbara Brown. I said, Barbara, how much are you spending on English history and literature acquisitions a year? And would $1 million endow that, $50,000, say, income? And she gave me some numbers, and then I said, well, what about Oxford, Cambridge Press? What do they cost a year? They're so damned expensive. And then I thought about some other things that, quote, we needed to have done, the computer center endowment and things that were in the campaign. And I thought, no, what I really would like, and what Ann would really like, is an indoor tennis court, because I'll never forget our 1988 national championship team having to play the finals up in Stanton. In an indoor three-court setup, because it was rainy, that had, of course, private bookings. You had to, Washington had to go in and say, we want to buy up the time of all of these folks who are ordinarily play on Thursday and Friday afternoons. And the foursome ladies said, we don't choose to be bought up. We are going to play. We always play at 3 o'clock on Thursday. So here's a national championship, Division III national championship being played out with two matches going full bore on 1 and 3, and the ladies in the two are paddling the ball back and forth for an hour and a half. And there was a spectator prospect of a tiny little lobby with one window that looked out into the number two court. You could see just barely, peripherally, the other two. I mean, I went home. I didn't stay. Couldn't watch it. It wasn't possible to watch it. And we had to go to Lynchburg, buy some court time earlier in the term.